Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Anne Brashears became an overnight sensation with her debut novel, The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, the story of four teenage friends who vow to keep their bond, their sisterhood, alive, wherever they might be, with a little help from some magical pants. Now, four books later, the pants are long gone, but the sisterhood is back. Older, nearly 30, and not quite intact, wrestling with very grown-up life as young women. This hour on Point, Anne Brashears and the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, all grown up. You can join the conversation. Did you grow up with the Traveling Pants, the books, Anne Brashears? What's your question for her now on friendship, on the writing life? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll hear of success and failure from late-night talk show host and commencement speaker Conan O'Brien. But joining me now in the studio is Anne Brashears, best-selling author of the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants series. Her new book out today is Sisterhood Everlasting. It's the fifth installment in the series. Anne Brashears, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And you're on book tour with a three-month-old baby.
I am.
My goodness, that must be a new experience.
It is, yeah. I mean, my next youngest child is just turned 10, so I haven't had a baby in a long time. So I'm having to remember slowly how to fold the stroller and, you know, buckle the car seat. It's a re-education.
And now, wait a minute. I seem to recall that when you first wrote the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, you were over 30 already.
I was. In fact, I was pregnant with my third child when I wrote my first book. And it was interesting because it was, you know, 10 years later, and yeah. I was embarking on this new book and discovered in the process that I was pregnant again. And
in your early, going toward mid-40s here.
Exactly, exactly.
Oh, my goodness.
And so there was an interesting symmetry there, you know, gestating a child, writing a book. It was sort of a fascinating thing and a little bit unexpected, to tell you the truth.
Book touring with a three-month-old. Name is?
Isaiah.
Isaiah. And you have how many boys and girls now?
I have three boys and a girl, which is exactly the family I grew up in, too.
But your subjects in your books are girls, 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 and famously so. These books were all over my house for a long time, and the movies, and you name it. And I was curious, you let your girls grow up. The Hardy Boys never grew up. Nancy Drew never grew up. When did you decide that the sisterhood would, you know, age? They're almost 30 now in your latest.
Yeah. You know, I think I always knew that I wanted to see them through time. I feel like you can't exactly develop a character if you can't use time. It's so significant, the passage of time in our lives. It's almost hard to imagine the human condition without it, I think. And to see how people age, how they change, how they evolve, time is necessary part of that. And I think there's something that feels, I mean, sort of wonderful in a way, but terribly artificial about trying to trap anyone in time.
It's certainly been done, but Harry Potter grows up, your girls are growing up. Let's get just a little sense. If you go back 10 years more, Anne Brashears first introduced her readers to this bond of the traveling pants. The girls meet together. Carmen, here played by America Ferrera in the 2005 movie version, tells her friends to use these shared pants as a way of keeping in touch even as they spend their summers apart.
Tonight, on the eve of our separation, magic has come to us in a pair of pants. And I'm proposing that we share them equally and that this summer they travel among us and they'll link us in hearts and spirits, even though we're far apart from each other.
Oh, boy. And the pants magic is at work there in the background music and you hear it. All right, Anne. We're going to have listeners who know these books inside out, backward and forward, and others scratching their heads and saying, what magical pants? I mean, we've heard of Jack and the Beanstalk, but what is, how did a pair of pants that sort of uncannily fit all these girls in their different shapes and sizes and uncannily hold them together, how did that come to be your motif?
Well, I've always had a kind of a superstitious relationship to clothing, I would say, and I've had some great clothes-sharing experiences in my life. My wedding dress, most notably, I shared with my three sisters-in-law and my old childhood friend. And I think pants. I love the word pants, for one thing.
It's just such a so does David Letterman. What's his company? Worldwide Pants.
There was a store near my... We used to live in Berkeley, California, my older brother, and there was a store called House of Pants near him. For some reason or other, that just... I thought that was just a great word
pants
to get
and
to use.
Friendship. Yeah. Friendship at the source of everything you write about.
Yeah. I think, you know, the idea of, you know, pants do travel. They do... form to fit, but at the same time, it's a challenging fit. You know, to have a T-shirt or a scarf that everybody can wear seems like no big deal, but to have a pair of pants, as people have pointed out, that can fit four different girls does verge on fantasy. I was joking with a friend that I can't share a pair of pants with myself from year to year.
let alone with three other people.
But I shared jeans with my friends when I was in high school.
And blue jeans do kind of carry the story of their lives, their wearer's life, I suppose, in the
they
way they're
do.
Worn.
I think you do. The fabric does somehow, I mean, it's metaphorical, of course, but it does somehow absorb the experiences, the feelings, the whole ethos of the time you spend in them.
Were you trying to instruct young women, tweens, in friendship? Was that where you were aiming when you got into this? Sort of, I'm going to lay out for you how friendship works. Let's take four girls, put them together, and see how their lives entwine, how their loyalties travel.
I think I didn't ever think of instruction exactly, but I do have... I think a very elevated and ambitious idea of friendship and a feeling of wanting to let that be front and center in a book and let the friendship not necessarily be the issue of the book in the sense that the conflicts aren't necessarily inside the friendship, but rather the conflicts happen to these girls and the friendship helps them through it. It helps them withstand the sort of traumas that life brings. I think, you know, in a way, I wanted to show the very positive view of friendship. And again, not so much as a didactic writer. I don't really think of myself as being one, but more for the pleasure of that, the beauty of that. And I think it's realistic, too. You know, it's funny, if I didn't think it was realistic before writing these books, I really, really do since I've written them, because every time I go to a bookstore or to a signing at a library or at a school, I feel like so many times in line come three girls with their arms around each other, and they show me the boots that they've been sharing or ask me to share, to sign the back of their jeans or tell me about, you know, ask me to sign a book. They've waited in line for 2 hours to sign a book for their best friend who couldn't come. And then women in their 50s or in their 60s who say, you know, we loved your books because it reflected the way we feel about each other, you know, the duration of our friendship. I just feel like it's brought out all of these wonderful stories. And and it's been a pleasure, and it's kind of made me feel like, hey, this is real.
Did you have that as a girl, as a tween? Your crowd, your team, your squad, your gang of tight knit gang of friends was, or is this a kind of fantasy of what that might be?
I would say it's probably maybe two parts real and one part big part fantasy. I did have very close friends growing up, and I'm still close to most of them now, and it was a pretty tight circle, but also it grew and it shrank, you know, depending on the year. And it wasn't as absolutely coherent and clear as the friendship that I write about. But there was definitely a sense of belonging to something for me, which was very valuable.
And now your then girls or tweens are nearly 30 in the latest Sisterhood Everlasting. That's a whole different set of questions. This is not teen love anymore.
Yeah, you're right.
It's quite serious stuff in a way.
It is. It is serious. You know, upon finishing the fourth book about the traveling pants, I knew that was the end of that part of their lives, and I wanted it to be. I wanted it to be a proper story with a beginning, with a middle, with an end. And at the same time, I knew I wanted to find these characters again in their lives that I had invested a lot in bringing them up in some ways. And so I wanted to come back to them, and I wanted to sort of avert my gaze for a few years and do some other things and try some other things, which I've done. And coming back to them, I was interested to sort of find out what my mood was and how I felt about them and where I would find them. And it wasn't, you know, I found I didn't want to write sort of a rosy reunion book. It didn't that wasn't the feeling I had when I was thinking about them. It did feel darker and in some ways more substantial than that.
Not everybody quite makes it here. I mean, they're all four very present in the book, but life has slipped away from one here.
Yeah, yeah.
Though you know, everybody has their voice very much still in this book, and they're up against quite grown-up challenges as they still kind of reference all their years and relationship throughout this and try to hang on
right.
to or even resurrect that teenage friendship that was so important to them.
Right. I mean, there is sort of a crucible in this book, and it changes everything for them and forces them to, leave behind some very important things, which is one of the great pains of growing up, is actually having to leave behind the things that you hold very, very dear. And they are forced to do that, and they're forced to grow up, and they're forced to reassess a lot of things. And it is it's traumatic.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with author of The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, Anne Brashears, about girls growing up, growing older, about her publishing franchise on young female friendship. Her latest in the series is Sisterhood Everlasting. Here's a little bit from the 2005 film again. Alex Bledel as Lena, Blake Lively as Bridget, America Ferrera as Carmen, Amber Tamblyn as Tibby. The girls of the Traveling Pants vowed to keep their friendship no matter what happened, even far into their futures.
To the pants.
And the sisterhood.
And the summer. And the rest of our lives.
Together and apart.
It becomes quite together and apart in Anne Brashears' latest, Sisterhood Everlasting. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Anne Brashears is with me in the studio on book tour with a three-month-old baby boy, Isaiah, and a whole lot of stories about growing up, even right up to the 30s, where her characters are in the latest. Let's go to our listeners. Windsor, Connecticut. Gabby's calling. Hi, Gabby. You're on the air with Anne Brashears.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
Well, I read the first three books the summer that the first movie came out.
Okay.
In 2005. I had just finished middle school, and one of my friends, who was a couple grades younger, invited me to see that movie.
Yeah.
as a graduation gift for to me, and that was my first exposure to the books. And I loved them so much, I read the first three right after. The fourth one still wouldn't be published for a few years.
Why did you love them so much, Gabby? Why?
Because they really showed non-superficial friendship between girls, and I really felt that they were developed into real characters. They had flaws, but they weren't like mean girl flaws. They were normal people flaws, and that they stayed friends
mm-hmm.
between them. And there was both diversity in their backgrounds, in their personalities, in their interests, and in their cultures and family styles, and I was really attracted to all of that.
Gabby, they grow up a lot in this new one. They're almost 30, but you've seen them grow up already a good deal if you've read three books. What did you feel about that? Did you want to see them get into, tougher, more grown-up, more serious circumstances, or did you wish they'd stay, young friends?
Well, I actually also read the fourth book years later, and I'm looking forward to reading the fifth one. I'm kind of nervous hearing that one of them doesn't turn out so well, but I look forward to seeing what happens to them. I've just grown out of my teen years myself, so I'm curious about seeing what their journey is. They'll be about 10 years older than me at this point. So.
And what about friendship? Have you modeled friendships on what you read in the book, or compared them to your own?
Well, coincidentally, a friend that I just got together with yesterday, after I had read the books, I had introduced them to her, and we decided that the summer when I was when we were both 16, and I was going to be away from the summer, we wanted to exchange an article of clothing that we would write stories on and pat and mail back and forth between us. For us, a pair of pants would not work, and so we did it with a T-shirt. And it was very hard. I have a lot of respect for the sisters in the book, the friends in the book who do it year after year, because I had it first. I had it for 2 weeks. I had written a story on it and mailed it to her, and she meant to mail it back to me, but never had time to.
Living the book, or almost. Gabby, Amber Scher is the author, sitting here with me right here. What's your word for her, your question, or your, what do you want to share with Anne?
Oh, my gosh. Wow. You've been one of my favorite authors in my high school years. On the spot, I can't think of a question, but I really love your book.
Thank you so much. It's so nice for me to hear you talk about them and talk about the things they meant to you. So I really, really appreciate that.
Gabby, thanks
so
much.
And my mom loves them too, so it's been a cool thing we've both gotten to share.
Gabby, thank you. Thank you so much. Let's get one more right here, if I may. Jennifer in Nashville, Tennessee. Jennifer, you're on the air with Anne Brashares.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I was lucky enough to go to a girls' school from 6th grade through 12th grade. And I have friends that I met at school there that are still, we are now all 50, just celebrating our 50th birthdays this
wow.
year. And we are still very best friends. We've been through breast cancer together. We've been losing parents together. And it's just, I just think it's incredibly important for women to have that support system.
Do you think it's more important somehow, Jennifer, for women, maybe even girls as well, than men?
Well, I think women tend to be more networking and more kind of social creatures, and I think that because women are the caregivers, both in their own families and then with their parents, generally speaking, that to have that support system as you get older is just really, really important. I think that men bond in different ways, but I think that generally speaking, at least what I've observed, the relationships between women tend to be deeper and, in some respects, more honest.
Now, you're 50 or so. Did you read these books, or do you just respond to the idea of a sisterhood?
I just respond to the idea of it, really. I did see the movie, and I haven't had a chance to sit down and read the books with careers and what have you. But I do love the idea of it.
Jennifer, I appreciate your call very much. Amber Scher, would you read a little bit for us from the prologue of the latest Sisterhood Everlasting, just to give us the flavor of where you're headed?
Yes, of course. Once upon a time, there were four pregnant women who met in an aerobics gym. I'm not joking. That's how this story begins. These large, fit, sweatband-sporting women bore four daughters, all born in and around the month of September. These girls started out as babies together and grew to be girls, and then women. A sisterhood, if you will. Growing up is hard on a friendship. There's no revelation in that. I remember my mom once told me that a good family is built for leaving, because that is what children must do. And I've wondered many times, is that also what a good friendship is supposed to be built for? Because ours isn't. We have no idea how to cope with leaving. And I'm probably the worst of all. If you need a picture, picture this. Me putting my hands over my eyes, pretending the leaving isn't happening, waiting for us all to be together again.
Amber Scher is reading from the prologue of her latest Sisterhood Everlasting in the Traveling Pants series. I mean, there's Jennifer in Nashville, 50, and still very much, you know, sort of with her posse of old friends. What do you see in your circles, Anne? Is that, I mean, you've got your crew back together at nearly 30. Do you see friendships lasting that long, or is that kind of a lucky dream? Jennifer's got it, your fictional characters have it, but most people, they move or they
yeah.
or not. Maybe in the Facebook era, the you know, crews stay together forever.
I think it's just as important when you're older. One of my dearest friends is traveling with me now to help me take care of the baby on
mm-hmm.
book tour.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I value my friends so much at this stage of life, and I know I'll continue to, and older women I look up to, their friendships are very important. I mean, a friend was doing a lot of research on happiness, and one of the conclusions she read about and told me about is that happiness depends in large part on how many women friends you have. And that's true for men, too. how many women friends they have. I think...
Wow, women friends is the measure of all happiness.
There was some studies that statistically seemed to support this, and maybe it's, you know, more anecdotal than scientific, but it struck me as being, you know, intuitively kind of true. I think women... we are sort of vulnerable with one another. We're allowed to show each other our seams and talk them through and love each other anyway and support each other through tough things. And I feel like friendship was intensely valuable to me when I was young, and continues to be so in different ways now, but no less valuable.
I've got questions for you, but we've got callers for you as well. Thomaston, Connecticut. Jennifer, you're on the air with Amber Shares.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. I've never read the books, but I'm about to. But I have a great story about a real sisterhood. I'm one of four girlfriends, and my husband has nicknamed us the Gaggle, because when we get together, we celebrate by finishing each other's stories and know exactly what we're saying, and we're all celebrating our 40th birthdays this year, and we've been all over the world traveling and experiencing life, and it's just so wonderful to know that you have four people who know you from elementary school, who you can just be yourself and just appreciate each other and don't have to pretend and start all over again as you do so often during your adult lives. So it's just wonderful to have that.
Jennifer, did you always think it would hang together? In her latest book, Amber Shares' crew, you know, they've sort of drifted apart in their 20s. I mean, the friendship's not gone, but they've got lives and babies. Maybe I hear one in your arms and lots of things going on. Did you ever think, well, I don't know, maybe life will pull us apart?
Well, I, you know, in our 20s and early 30s, we had drifted apart because some of us did start families earlier than others.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think in our late 30s, we all realized that it's something really special, so we all made a really big effort to remain close and reconnect again. But I think all of our different experiences have made us even stronger. And what we are today, and we're able to share our different experiences through life. But yeah, it did kind of dip in our 20s, because that's when you go off to college and, you know, you have all these different experiences. But we just always come back, and I think that's the beauty of girlfriends, is that, you know, it's like, you know, figure eight. It weaves back and forth. So it is. But it did do that, but it always came back to something wonderful.
That old infinity symbol. Jennifer, thank you so much. Take care there with the wind and the baby. And how did you imagine the challenges? I mean, broadly here, the challenges of tween friends now in their late 20s, there's a particular set of challenges maybe that come along with the 20s. How did you set out to think about what they might be buffeted by at that time, them in their own lives and their friendship?
Right. I think friendship, it's, you know, it's never easy to create and maintain a really good, strong friendship. I think it does take some work. But in some ways, it's easier when your context is totally shared, the way it is in elementary school or middle school or high school. You probably live in the same town as your friends. You likely go to the same school. You can
same
complain
teachers,
about the
recess,
teachers,
you name it.
The same boy that you love or don't love. Or you know, it's all a shared context. And then that is pulled apart. Typically, when people get into their late teens and 20s and often go to college or, you know, do whatever they do, the context is no longer entirely shared. And I think that really is a challenge. And I think it's often the case that friendships do dip in the 20s, because it's the time when you are setting up your lives and going in all kinds of different directions. And then I think, as Jennifer says, I really agree with her. You come back, you do. You find your friends again. You realize how much you need them. And I think friendship in later life, in your 30s and 40s and beyond, the thing you learn is that you do have to work for it. You do have to create the context together. I think you do have to make time for one another. You know, as much kind of love and sort of spiritual bonding may occur between two women,
there's a practical face to it also.
Yeah, to have coffee every week is essential. You know, just to check in, to be part of each other's lives.
Yeah, if you're close enough to do it.
Yeah, it's really important. Or even to just check in on the phone once a week. It's the routine and the ritual. I mean, I tried to kind of ritualize friendship to some degree in my books. And I think, you know, to ritualize friendship is a way of really holding it together.
Let's get a call from Orlando, Florida. And Ruth, you're on the air with Amber Shares.
Hi. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Ruth. What do you know?
I'm fine. I am thoroughly enjoying this. We are driving north, and I'm listening to you on the car radio.
Great.
I am 75 years old, and I have a friend that I've been friends with since we were 9 years old, and we are still friends. And we've lived all over the country and have never lost touch with each other, and we've been through just about everything there is to go through in our lives. And there is nothing in the world like good friendship.
Ruth, you're a lucky lady for that, and I'm glad you called. I appreciate that. That's a beautiful long stretch from 9 to 75. You know, I found myself wondering, your book came out in 2001, Anne, and thanks again, Ruth, for calling. Came out in 2001, just about the same time we started seeing this spate of articles saying, you know, girls are stepping up, girls are taking over, girls are getting higher grades, higher scores, getting into college more. There was sort of an empowered sense about your book at the same time. Do you think friendship is it any different? Is it more or less necessary in an era when young women, girls even, are sort of, you know, more, they got more wingspan than they had before? And somehow your book seemed to speak to that, even though it was built around friendship themes that go way back in literature around women and young women.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, girls are, I mean, this is sort of a basic, I guess, philosophical idea, you know, that somehow girls are stronger when they hold together, and certainly more than when they're very competitive with each other. And I feel like there's been so much representation of girls being very competitive, particularly as teenagers, mm-hmm. and taking each other down and sort of
mean girls.
Yeah, and enjoying
all
each other's failures. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's certainly a part of the story, and that's realistic too. But I really feel like the bigger story and the more important story is girls who really do take great pleasure in each other's successes and lead each other to greater successes and really support each other. That's a friendship I'm writing about, and it doesn't, you know, it has its faults and its failures occasionally.
Who's winning in our popular culture, the mean girl theme people or the sisterhood theme people?
That's a good and probably enduring question. But I really do feel like as girls grow stronger and as they grow more successful in the world and their opportunities increase, I think women who help other women and help girls are doing a great deal to help that happen.
Lord help the mister who comes between me and my sister. And Lord help the sister who comes between me and my man. Sisters, sisters, sister, don't come between me and my man.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the author of The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, Anne Brashears, about girls growing up, growing older, hanging on to friendships. She's with me in the studio. Suzanne is calling right now from Providence, Rhode Island. Suzanne, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is Susan,
excuse me. Yeah, sorry. Hi, Susan. Hi.
I've had the same group of friends since we were in first grade. We're now 56. And we went to Aquin Central Catholic High School together,
right.
And we call ourselves the Aquin Girls.
All right.
And that was in Freeport, Illinois.
Yeah.
And every third week in July, we all get together and rent a house and have a vacation together.
So it's coming up. What does it mean for you, that annual get-together, the old girlfriends?
Well, it's more than just the annual. It's that we're always there for each other no matter what happens. We're out at funerals, at weddings, at birthdays, everything. We celebrate together, and we know that we have these deep tap roots that we've put together, and they're just irreplaceable.
Susan, I'm so glad to hear you describe that. I mean, it's this theme. People who are lucky enough to have it are with us today, and I appreciate it. One more right here. Elin in Buffalo, New York. Elin, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a church organist, and I'm always planning weddings, with meeting with brides, young brides. And I always give them the advice, keep your girlfriends. And they usually look at me, they kind of move back a little bit and look, and I look at them again, and I say, trust me, keep your good girlfriends.
Well, you're getting a husband, but hang on to the girlfriends.
Absolutely. You know, your husband only looks at you starry-eyed across the table for just so long.
Ooh, we hope it's longer than that.
But then you got to make sure you got your girlfriends.
Elin, there's the voice from behind the organ at the wedding. I love it, Elin. Thanks so much. And one more, Sag Harbor, New York, Sal. Sal, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. Hi. I'm the father of three daughters. And
congratulations.
I had the opportunity to share the movie in the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pair in the movie theaters with them, which led to conversations I don't think I would have had otherwise, particularly about the different kinds of friends you encounter in your life, friends that are supportive, and how to distinguish a true friend, somebody that will tell you when you have egg on your face, and be critical yet supportive. It was very valuable for me to be able to share that with them.
Sal, let me ask you, you're the first guy we've got on the line today. When you hear all this celebration of female friendship, girls, young women, women, old women, as a man, do you recognize it? Do you envy it? Do you have the same thing in your life?
I am very fortunate to have a number of very close friends, and I believe that has helped my daughters value friendship and the importance of people that are there for you in the hard times when things don't go well and help you through them. And I think that was a theme that Amber was able to capture very well. And I will encourage my daughters to read her latest book as well.
Sal, that's great, and I really appreciate your call. The book, Working Its Way Right Into How People Think About Friendship. Amber shares with me here in the studio. Take us back to when you were writing the first one. What were you doing? Where were you? How did it happen?
Well, I was...
You said you were 30-something already.
Right. It was 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I was living in Brooklyn and mm-hmm. had two kids at the time and expecting a third, mm-hmm. and I had been working kind of peripherally in publishing for a number of years and had, I've always been so much attracted to books and writing and reading and with editing, learning to think about books more analytically, taking them apart, trying to put them back together mm-hmm. and improve them.
What
and
exactly
work with
makes
writers.
A book a good book?
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. And so little by little, it took me about 10 years to get up my courage to try to write something. And The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants was my first book.
And you had been editing young adult fiction,
so you'd been
sort of up to your hips in this stuff. The manuscripts would come in. If they were going to go back out again, you'd be working on them.
Yes, I would. Very closely, yeah. And so in
did that
part,
give you the courage to do your own?
I think it did, because I worked on such a range of books with such a range of writers. And to tell you the truth, you know, not all books are great books. And, you know, we did some very commercial mm-hmm. things, and some of them were wonderful and some of them were less wonderful. And mm-hmm. I always worked very hard to get kind of the best we could out of any writer and any manuscript.
Which meant pulling out your own pencil in
those small
time.
Yeah. But, I mean, to be kind of act as midwife to a lot of books
mm-hmm.
gave me a level of comfort and ultimately at least enough confidence to try it. But partly, you know, I had such a kind of a idealized, you know, notion of books growing up, reading, you know, Louisa May Alcott and Frances Hodgson Burnett and those kinds of books.
The greats.
Yeah, and thinking mm-hmm. of books as being like just these objects of total perfection.
Mm-hmm. Unclimbable towers.
Yes, yeah. And I thought, oh my gosh, I could never, ever, ever hope to be a writer. But then working, you know, with sort of, you know, up to your elbows in not perfect prose and knowing that a book is a process
mm-hmm.
and that a lot goes into it and that they're not all great. And it was, you know, it demystified it significantly over the course of 10 years, which made me think partly the reason why I'm so attracted to this, why I want to spend my days and often my nights working with words and sentences
mm-hmm.
and trying to make characters that feel real, is because it's really, really what I want to do.
You got a big publisher very interested early on in Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants. I mean, Random House came in here, and they really got behind this book. What made that happen? You know, what do you think was they've got a keen eye. They're looking for things that they think are going to intersect with the zeitgeist, with young
right.
women at that time. You know, was it words? Was it, was it sisterhood? Was it pants? Was
right.
it traveling? What said to those big editors, oh, let's put the marketing machine to work here?
I think probably sisterhood is the word here. And
mm-hmm.
I think, you know, as some of our callers would testify, it's a powerful idea and a and a beautiful one. And so I think that's...
And a timely one, maybe, because women were feeling empowered.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think even demographically, probably the timing was somewhat right in the sense that a lot of kids were growing into teenagers. Mm-hmm. You know, the young adult part of the book publishing industry was very, very quiet for a number of years, to the point that very little was being published into it because...
No more. Between Harry Potter and Twilight, and you name it, it's blown up.
That's been fascinating to watch. It really has been. It's probably the most active part of publishing now. And that's exciting because teenagers are reading and adults are interested in many of the same books. There's a lot of crossover. You know, the distinctions are...
Adults reading young adult fiction.
Exactly.
Is that weird or is that good?
I think people should read what they want to read. And if a young adult... I mean, again, I think sometimes the categories and distinctions aren't all that meaningful.
I mean, once your characters are 29,
right?
That's certainly not young adult anymore. That's just adult.
Right. I mean, I think... You know, people used to say, well, I love, you know, a 40-year-old woman would say, I love your books, but I felt self-conscious when somebody saw me reading it on the subway or something.
Girl stuff.
And I feel like that, you know, first of all, writers have been writing about teenagers, you know, from the beginning of the novel because it's a pretty fascinating time of life.
We just had a big conversation on Jane Eyre here not long ago.
Oh, really?
She must have been right about there.
She's 10, I think, when the book starts and probably 18 when it ends, 19,
so there you
20.
Are, traveling fans age.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's when you're laying the blueprint for your life. It's a very dramatic time and you feel things dramatically.
Let me get a call from Peter in Stockbridge, Vermont. Peter, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd just like to ask a question about the pressure of coming up with consistently great stories now that, you know, the brand of the Traveling Pants is so huge. And I was just wondering, you know, if you felt any pressure writing the next book.
Dealing with that success when it strikes, and it's right. The rare lightning, but when it comes, what about that, Anne?
I think that does make the next book a little bit harder. Again, it's always the beginning that's hard. It's always when you're in that sort of conceptual phase and you think this has to be good and I don't want to disappoint anyone and I actually have readers and they're interested in what I write, and that feels like a really giant responsibility. And I felt that for the second book that I wrote and the third and beyond, I did feel that responsibility very keenly. But I realized that as I started writing, reconnect with the characters, immersed myself in their world, started to think their thoughts once again, that a lot of those worries fell away. And I just got back into their life and their world, and it just started to come somewhat naturally and organically.
How long can you stick with these characters? I mean, now you've taken them from tween years to 29, going on 30. Are we going to be reading about them when they're 39 and 49 and 59 and when you're 79?
Right. I know. There are many possibilities here. I don't know. I mean, I sort of thought when I started this one that this might be kind of a finale.
Mm-hmm.
But it was funny. I think I sort of hate to say goodbye to characters. You know, you sort of raise them. Like a parent, you invest so much in them that it's hard to say, okay, I'm not going to come back to you. I'm not going to think about you again. I think even if I don't write about them, I will certainly continue to think about them. As I got to the end of this book, I did feel like, oh my gosh, there's a bunch of things I still don't know. There's a bunch of things I want to know about these people.
We just got a minute. Give us some clues. What are some of these for wrestling with in your latest?
In this book?
Yes.
Well, a lot of it has to do with moving on from a very glorified and idealized past and learning to put roots down. You know, to become adults and commit to new things, whether it's marriage or children. And there's some of that. And how to move beyond a tragedy, too.
And roots in a time when that youth can kind of go on forever and they're wrestling with whether or not to get into commitments.
That's exactly, because you have to commit, and that means closing the door on many, many possibilities. And that is the hardship of growing up, that you have to say no to a lot of things.
The sisterhood of the settling down pants.
Exactly.
Maybe. Oh, boy. Amber Scherz, it's terrific to have you with us. We know we've got your 3-month-old waiting in the wings for you. We don't want to keep you forever. Congratulations on the new book.
Thank you.
And with the rest of your rolling out here, we've got an excerpt at our website of Amber Scherz's latest, Sisterhood Everlasting, at the website. 5th in the series. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
In a moment, comedian Conan O'Brien's words of wisdom for 2011 graduates. This is On Point. Over the past few weeks, we've been airing excerpts of commencement addresses from across the country. On Sunday, comedian and late-night host Conan O'Brien addressed the graduating class of Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. He told the graduates that though you should not fear failure, you should do your best to avoid it, and went on to speak about his famous falling out with NBC and The Tonight Show. Failure leads to reinvention, he said, and the redefinition of success. Here's Conan O'Brien.
Your path at 22 will not necessarily be your path at 32 or 42. One's dream is constantly evolving, rising and falling, changing course. This happens in every job, but because I have worked in comedy for 25 years, I can probably speak best about my own profession. Way back in the 1940s, there was a very, very funny man named Jack Benny. He was a giant star, easily one of the greatest comedians of his generation. And a much younger man named Johnny Carson wanted very much to be Jack Benny. In some ways he was, but in many ways he wasn't. He emulated Jack Benny, but his own quirks and mannerisms, along with the changing medium, pulled him in a different direction. And yet, his failure to completely become his hero made him the funniest person of his generation. David Letterman wanted to be Johnny Carson, and was not. And as a result, my generation of comedians wanted to be David Letterman. And none of us are. My peers and I have all missed that mark in 1,000 different ways. But the point is this: it is our failure to become our perceived ideal that ultimately defines us and makes us unique. It's not easy, but if you accept your misfortune and handle it right, your perceived failure can become a catalyst for profound reinvention. So, at the age of 47, after 25 years of obsessively pursuing my dream, that dream changed. For decades in show business, the ultimate goal of every comedian was to host The Tonight Show. It was the Holy Grail. And like many people, I thought that achieving that goal would define me as successful. But that is not true. No specific job or career goal defines me, and it should not define you. In 2000, I told graduates to not be afraid to fail. And I still believe that. But today, I tell you that whether you fear it or not, disappointment will come. The beauty is that through disappointment, you can gain clarity. And with clarity comes conviction and true originality. Many of you here today are getting your diploma at this Ivy League school because you have committed yourself to a dream and worked hard to achieve it. And there is no greater cliche in a commencement address than follow your dream. Well, I'm here to tell you that whatever you think your dream is now, it will probably change. And that's okay. 4 years ago, many of you had a specific vision of what your college experience was going to be and who you were going to become. And I bet today most of you would admit that your time here was very different from what you imagined. Your roommates changed. Your major changed. For some of you, your sexual orientation changed. I bet some of you have changed your sexual orientation since I began this speech. I know I have. But through the good, and especially the bad, the person you are now is someone you could never have conjured in the fall of 2007. I've told you many things today, most of it foolish, but some of it true. I'd like to end my address by breaking a taboo and quoting myself from 17 months ago. At the end of my final program with NBC, just before signing off, I said, "Work hard, be kind, and amazing things will happen." Today, receiving this honor and speaking to the Dartmouth class of 2011 from behind a tree trunk, I have never believed that more. Thank you very much and congratulations.
comedian Conan O'Brien addressing Dartmouth College graduates on Sunday. You can watch the full video of his address at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Alex Kingsbury, Stefano Katsonis, Kate Osborne, and James Ross, with help from Matt Baskin, Mabe, Dean Russell, Aisha Siddiqui. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.